Welcome to the CSIS podcast. I'm Colm Quinn. President Trump has made no secret of where he stands on China's trade relationship with the U.S.
If you look at what's happening with trade in China, it hasn't been fair for many, many years to the United States, and we're going to solve that problem.
So this week, a senior trade delegation, including the Secretary of the Treasury, Steve Mnuchin, and the Secretary of Commerce, Wilbur Ross, headed to Beijing to find a way to defuse the tensions over trade between the two countries. We'll hear later in the show how that went and whether it edges the world's two largest economies to an all-out trade war. But first, another crucial date is on the horizon for the future of the Iran deal. By May 12th, President Trump has a decision to make on whether to continue a waiver on sanctions against Iran that were suspended as part of the agreement between Iran and P5 plus 1 in 2015. Trump is no fan of the deal and could try to extract further concessions from Iran as part of new negotiations. In Iran, Foreign Minister Javad Zarif was adamant that amendments to the deal were not up for discussion.
To put it in real estate terms, when you buy a house and move your family in, or demolish it to build a skyscraper, you cannot come back 2 years later and try to renegotiate the price.
To talk us through the options Trump has in the lead-up to May 12th is Anthony Cordesman, the Burke Chair in Strategy at CSIS. Approaching May 12th, what kind of options does the president have?
The president has already said previously, twice, that the agreement is not being honored in terms of its spirit, that Iran is not fully complying, that he cannot certify that Iran is in full compliance.
What is the purpose of a deal that, at best, only delays Iran's nuclear capability for a short period of time? This, as President of the United States, is unacceptable.
So he can do this again. That still leaves the sanctions issue unaddressed. He is not restoring sanctions. He can set conditions. These can be conditions which apply to our allies rather than simply to Iran, that he will not continue to waive the sanctions unless our allies take specific actions. And these can focus on the missile threat from Iran, its regional actions, or other aspects of its conduct. He can put pressure on Iran, saying that Iran has to meet certain criteria, or he will cease to continue to waive sanctions. And he can put pressure on any given aspect of the security problems with Iran, although logically what he would do is to set deadlines that are relating to either the nuclear activities or the missiles. Now, he also can argue that Iran has effectively been shown to have lied and is in a partial material breach. This is, frankly, one of the points that Prime Minister Netanyahu raised, which a lot of people have ignored, but it is technically valid. So he could use that to put pressure on Iran to admit that it had nuclear weapons programs. It's unclear our allies, Russia or China, would join him in this, but he could do this, and it would create added pressure. The reason it's unclear anyone would join us is that we knew, and all of the other members of the 5 plus 1 knew, that Iran had a nuclear weapons program. Effectively, everyone chose to ignore the fact it had the program, because their goal was to end the program, not to sort of fight over the historical reasons that you had an arms control agreement.
So putting more sanctions on doesn't necessarily nullify the deal.
It doesn't necessarily nullify the agreement. The U.S. can't nullify the agreement. Basically, if the U.S. unilaterally withdraws, Iran can then claim that the United States has committed a material breach of the agreement, and it is effectively no longer binding to Iran. Or Iran can work with the other members of the 5 plus 1 if they do not see the agreement as being in breach. And this could get into a situation where the president makes a unilateral decision, and the question would then be whether the U.S. alone restoring sanctions would somehow force European and other countries to stop dealing with Iran because they can't risk jeopardizing financial transactions with a power as large as the United States for the relatively tiny economic and trade value of dealing with Iran.
From what we talked about previously with this May 12th issue, there seems like a lot could happen. There's a lot of different ways that could be approached, different things that could snap on and off. So not knowing what will happen, what's the path that you'd recommend?
Well, I think that the path that I would recommend is one which our European allies to some extent have begun to pursue, and pursued really because we have pushed for it. One is that you do seek over time to have the agreement changed. The key elements that people would like to change involve the time limits to the agreement, which are sometimes exaggerated because Iran has agreed indefinitely to halt its nuclear programs and has agreed to indefinitely subject itself to inspection by the International Atomic Energy Agency. There is no time limit to Iran's agreement not to proliferate. The agreements affect centrifuge development, some aspects of research, and within this, there are agreements which affect some aspects of enrichment, because Iran presumably will go on to other nuclear power plants. There is a separate track. The UN originally had discussed the issue of Iran's longer-range missile programs. Now, there is some, I think, confusion. It did not literally forbid having longer-range, higher-payload missiles. But it did indicate that if these were capable of lifting and delivering a nuclear weapon, they should be halted. How much that basically prohibits Iranian action is a matter of debate. What a number of European allies, particularly France, have advanced is the idea of putting a separate agreement up for negotiation on longer range missiles. Since Iran has no reason, basically, no conceivable reason, to try to create an ICBM with a conventional warhead to go all the way to the distance of striking the United States. The status of this track is unclear. Obviously, the President of France did discuss it with President Trump during his visit. It seems likely that the German Chancellor, Merkel, also discussed it to some extent, but none of us know how far this went. There also is the idea of creating some kind of agreement on Iran's part where it would withdraw from its expansion of its security presence in countries like Syria and Iraq and restrict the role of its support to the Hezbollah. It's uncertain that this particular effort has actually gotten anywhere. Now, Iran has said that it is not going to deal or accept any resumption of sanctions. It has charged the U.S. with being non-compliant because the U.S. has not waived the non-nuclear sanctions, so the U.S. is already applying some sanctions to Iran. And it is certainly not indicated that it is going to alter any of its gains in terms of its presence in Lebanon through the Hezbollah, or in Syria, Iraq, and to some extent Afghanistan. So the truth of the matter is we don't know how far any kind of compromise between the U.S. and its European allies got, and we've had no indication that Iran is ready to accept any expansion of these arms control agreements.
And that was Anthony Cordesman. And now to trade and the talks between the US and China aimed at resolving their many trade disputes. I sat down with Bill Reinch, the Scholl Chair in International Business at CSIS, to talk us through the US position and what's coming next. The US sent the heavies to Beijing, Mnuchin, Lighthizer, Wilbur Ross, Pete Navarro.
The whole gang.
The whole gang. What were they trying to achieve at this summit?
We had a debate beforehand about what they were trying to achieve, because with the president, you never know if he really wants to achieve what they said in advance they wanted to achieve, which is significant change in Chinese domestic economic policies and an end to their subsidies of technologies and an end to their intellectual property theft, you know, or whether he'll get enamored of short-term market access concessions. You know, the Chinese promised to reduce the bilateral deficit. They promised to reduce the car tariff, and then he goes away happy. So we didn't know what they would go for, and the answer is they went for everything. You know, they asked for the sun and the moon and the stars. China, in return, asked for all the planets. So both, you know, they kind of matched us. You know, demand for demand. We wanted a lot of changes in their technology policies that have been forecast. We wanted them to abandon the subsidies that are contained in their Made in China 2025 program. But we also demanded that they reduce the deficit by $200 billion between now and 2020. And there were some new things that I hadn't seen before that were mostly defensive. We demanded that they not retaliate against us for anything we do to them, and that they continue to, you know, make the changes that we demand. That they don't fight with us in the WTO, and they accept our various measures against them. I don't think they're likely to do that, but that was on our list of demands.
Is this just a shot across the bow, kind of an opening bid, or is this? What you consider
yes.
U.S. position?
Yes, it was like NAFTA, and in a sense, and Korea, in a sense, you're going in with the maximum demand, and basically you say, give us everything, and we will give you nothing, and that doesn't work usually. It hasn't worked so far, but it you know at least they put something on paper. An 8-page document of what they wanted. So now at least there's something to, I guess, work from. No ground was gained. It ended kind of a draw. What was noteworthy, I think, was it did not end with them screaming at each other, which is a good thing because it means there will be more talks. And the Chinese tactic will probably be to drag this out as long as possible. And the president has demonstrated that he's not a patient person, so it'll be interesting to see how that goes.
The U.S. was talking about, you know, they were talking to China about you know, the subsidies they give to their industries and how they want them to cut that out, essentially. How much power does the U.S. have to actually force China's hand?
Well, good question. You know, I think that when Ambassador Lighthizer spoke last week here in Washington, He made the point that, you know, there are limits to what we can tell them to do about their own economy. On the other hand, the subsidies that they're proposing to give are, I think, probably illegal under WTO rules because they will end up doing exactly what they did in steel and aluminum, and that is creating overcapacity, you know, because this is an economy where credit is allocated by the government and not by the market. And when that happens, the government says, in this case, semiconductors are really important. We're going to invest a lot. The next tranche is apparently $50 billion in semiconductor development, R&D, and production. Well, that's a lot of money. And what happens is they overinvest. They make too many. And then they dump them all on the world market and export their problem. That's exactly what happened in steel and aluminum. And WTO rules say you really can't do that. So in that sense, yes, we can go back to them and say, you're causing a big problem. I think we'll also say you're probably causing a problem for your own economy as well as everybody else. And you know, at a later point, we can come back and stop you via international rules it would be simpler if we do that right now.
There's a lot of complexity, obviously, in this because of how interconnected the world's economies are. One company that the U.S. sanctioned, one Chinese company, ZTE, they were using U.S. chips, I suppose, on their phones. And now if they're sanctioned, would that even accelerate what China has been trying to do, which is create its own homegrown?
Well, that's a good question. And that's exactly what Xi Jinping commented on after we did the ZTE ban. He gave a speech, and one of the things he said was that. He says, this demonstrates that the foreigners are not reliable suppliers and that China has to build its own industry. We have to do this ourselves. So what we've done, and we had very good reason to do it, you know, I think they broke the law. But what we've done only validates in Xi Jinping's mind that he's pursuing the right policy.
You know, they had 2 days of talks and nothing concrete at the end of it. Is it possible things, relations between U.S. and China on this are going to get worse?
Yes, I think they will at some point because the Chinese are going to be either unwilling or unable to meet our demands. Particularly in technology. I mean, we're asking them to do things that first would change the way they operate their economy, and they're not going to be happy about that. And second, in the digital trade sphere, where a lot of this takes place, what we're really asking them to do are not, for them, trade things. They're national security things and public control things. You know, when you ask them not to agree to forced localization of data storage, for example, requirements that data for example, e-pay transactions or, you know, credit cards, things like that, should not have to be stored in China. What you're really saying is, you know, we don't want you to get your hands on American data and American consumers' data. And what they're saying is it's not about American consumers, it's about Chinese consumers. And we want access to that data because that's how we control the internet. And that's how we control the population. That's not a trade issue. And that's going to be very hard to solve by trade negotiators. So I think, to get back to your question, in the end, yes, things are going to get worse because we're not going to be able to come to terms unless they buy us off with market access concessions.
So the next meeting maybe have even more heavies, state, CIA, things like that.
Well, we'll see. I mean, what surprised me about it was everyone here was expecting the Chinese to offer up some concessions, you know, to reduce the deficit, not by $200 billion, but by some smaller number, maybe unilaterally reduce the car tariff because the president's talked about that. Things that are not big but are concessions. And as near as I can tell, they didn't do that. They just showed up with a list of demands of their own. So they sort of matched our tone and they matched our approach. I think probably the next time around or the third time around, they will come up with some token concessions because they want to see what we do. And I don't know what we'll do. We'll just have to wait and find out.
Before I let you go, you are our latest addition to the podcast stable at CSIS. You are a trade guy.
Scott Miller and I are the trade guys, and we are in the process of putting together a series of podcasts where we try to make complicated issues a little bit more simple to people that are not trade guys like us and don't live and breathe this stuff every day. So hopefully, if you listen to us, you'll find out what's going on China, on NAFTA, on the late TPP, and whether it's coming back. I think we'll be getting to Europe, too. We're sort of an equal opportunity commenter as far as the world goes. So it's a chance to learn.
Episode 1 is out this week. I'll include that in the show's description. And that was Bill Reinch rounding out another CSIS podcast. Thanks again to Yumi Araki for her production. I've enjoyed reading and replying to your messages about the show, and so remember, if you've any feedback or suggestions for topics, you can email me at cquinn@csis.org or find me on Twitter. Until next week, that's it from me. I'm Colin Quinn. Thanks for listening.